Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is The Week from In the Loop. Of course, we began the last 7 days with one major story. Thousands displaced, a mid-sized city wrecked, and an American death toll nearing 60 now from Hurricane Ike. But then the hurricane gets blown off the front pages by another Category 1 headline. They subpoenaed Sarah Palin's husband. I can't believe it. I really didn't think that... Oh, I'm sorry. I mean, the U.S. economy teetering on the brink of collapse. Or not. On Monday, the biggest one-day market drop since 9/11 scares us all witless. People were evacuating the markets faster than they got out of Galveston. Then, somewhere between pouring billions into a failing insurance company, resurrecting a 20-year-old system to take bad loans off the hands of the private sector, and banning people from making money when stocks go down, the markets surged. And we're basically back where we were last Friday, before all this happened. Regulation is back, big time. And apparently we all feel much, much better about that. Now, I think I can speak for most typical investors when I say a week like this really messes with your head. When the market plunges, the predominant advice is to sit tight, right? Don't sell in a panic. How many times did you hear that this week? But in the moment, that can be tough to take. I mean, the market wouldn't be falling if tons of other people weren't doing the opposite, bailing out. And the Dow may be back up again today, and believe me, that feels good, but it sounds like we're in for a rough road ahead. In the midst of the plunge this week, we sent out an email to our network of listeners all around the country, the Public Insight Network, we call it, and we asked what was going through their heads when they contemplated their investments. We got tons of comments back, ranging from scared to enthusiastic to downright biblical.
I'm paying strict attention, but in this house, we do not panic. It's not our style.
I'm young. Wait it out. Come 2010, things will be right as rain.
I'm a retired firefighter. This is like most fires. They all go out eventually. Well, except for that coal mine out in West Virginia decades ago.
Right now, I'm completely ignoring my portfolio.
Have I changed my investments since the drop? Yes. I'm now investing in Mad Magazine instead of the Wall Street Journal.
What are you supposed to do? Not read the paper? Not listen to the radio?
I just turn off Marketplace and pretend everything is as it should be.
I don't need as much money as I have. I can spend less and have lots of fun.
I can't wait for the stock market to go up. This will be fun.
Think what a great deal I'm getting on my investments right now when I buy. It's like buying Macy's jeans on sale at Walmart.
The market is crashing. Hot dog. Sit on your assets and get ready to buy, buy, buy.
Does it get me down? Sure it does. Ulcers are not a distant thought since I'm already retired.
It scares me to death. This is it. All my retirement funds in one place. I always thought, what's safer than Merrill Lynch? I still don't know.
And having food and raiment, let us be there with content. But they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. Timothy chapter 6, verse 8.
That final comment from a listener in Tennessee, who answered each question we had about investing with a relevant Bible verse. Nice work. Also heard comments there from New York, Florida, South Dakota, California, West Virginia, and a few from here in Minnesota. Thanks to various voices from our newsroom for helping bring them to life. Later in the show, we'll get another take on the financial crisis from a banker with a fondness for fables about insects. We'll also talk later about that other big story, in case you forgot, Hurricane Ike. But before we do that, I don't know if it's the 11,000,000% inflation, the spectacle of a teetering dictator, or the absolute insanity of trying to place telephone calls there, but here on The Week, we have kind of a fondness for Zimbabwe. We first talked with Terence Mashinga Idze a couple of months ago when we wanted a sense of how dire the economic situation was in his home country. This week, we've got a breakthrough political deal that might help set things right, so we got back in touch. Terence is joining us from Bulawayo, the second largest city. Terence, how you doing?
Oh, I'm fine.
Now, let's quickly go over the details of this deal. Robert Mugabe gets to stay the president. Opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai, he is going to become the prime minister. You have been, for a while now, a supporter of the opposition in Zimbabwe. Is this deal enough to satisfy you?
I think it's a good deal because the country could not move forward the context of political polarization and continued economic decline.
We're hearing today, Terrence, that the first steps of power sharing are maybe not going so well. They can't agree, it sounds like, on who gets to appoint which cabinet posts. Is it possible, you think, that this whole thing could still fall apart?
I don't think the deal will falter or will fall apart, because the two parties involved in the deal, the MDC and ZANU-PF, know very well that for the country to move forward, for the economy to stabilize and for inflation to be put to check, there's needs for them to come together. And also we need to remember that the negotiations leading to the signing of the Memorandum of Understanding took quite some time. This haggling over cabinet posts, I think, is a normal political process.
You mentioned the runaway inflation in Zimbabwe and other very difficult conditions. Have there been any immediate effects that you can sense on conditions in Zimbabwe since the deal was signed?
No. Prices are, in fact, still going up. But the only thing that has started going down are the foreign currency rates on the black market. They've been tumbling over the past few days.
Those prices on the black market for foreign currencies, that would seem to suggest that people have generally a certain amount of confidence that this deal will hold out and things will improve.
Yeah, I think it's one of the indicators. But I think the major indicator would be the stabilization of prices in the shops and also inflation rates.
What will be some of the signals to you that this deal is working as the government goes forward?
For me, there are a number of indicators. Most important would be the allocation of government posts, such as those of finance, defense, state security, and foreign affairs. If ZANU-PF and the MDC share equally these critical posts, that would show the seriousness in the deal. The second point would be fair media coverage.
I'm sorry, you said fair media coverage?
Yes. In Zimbabwe, people get much of their news through the state-controlled media. So in this state-controlled media, there's been a lot of denigration of the opposition, the MDC. So I think one of the major indicators that the deal is working would be the fair treatment of opposition political leaders and members of the opposition in the media.
The perception that that I had from watching and reading about things over here is that President Mugabe, you know, shook hands on this deal, he signed it, but that he was very unhappy about doing so. Is that your sense as well?
Oh, yes, because when he gave his speech during the signing of the deal, he was, his speech was not all that conciliatory. And also, a day ago, he also expressed regret for not having worked hard for his party to win the March 29 election. Definitely, there's an element of regret on his part. I don't think he's totally committed to the deal.
What support does Zimbabwe need, you think, from the U.S. and the rest of the world to help make this work?
The major issue relates to investment, because with investment, there will be employment, and also a number of industries will begin to tick. Of course, some people might say aid is necessary, but I think what the country really needs is investment.
Maybe some investment in better telephone infrastructure, among other things.
Definitely, yes.
Always a challenge getting in touch with people in Zimbabwe. And Terrence, thank you for your patience with us. Great to talk with you again.
Okay, that's fine. Thanks very much.
That's Terrence Mashinga-Idze with us from Bulawayo, Zimbabwe. This is The Week from In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. Subscribe to the podcast at minnesotapublicradio.org. Other international developments this week were not quite as promising as Zimbabwe. Pakistan seems a little confused about the whole ally in the war on terror thing. Really, the whole ally thing in general. The army says it will shoot us if we pursue terrorists from Afghanistan onto Pakistani soil. In the meantime, we continue to do just that. Suggests something interesting. Our two governments may be pretending to hate each other as a cover for actually getting stuff done. And in Ukraine, just when you'd kind of like them to hang tight, governing coalition there fell apart. Good news for Russia. Worth noting that Russia did make a scheduled delivery of supplies this week to the International Space Station. Good to see we can all still get along outside of Earth's atmosphere. Couldn't help but note it was a big week for Matt Damon. First, he challenges Sarah Palin to admit whether she believes in dinosaurs. Then he's all over TV handing out relief to hurricane victims in Haiti. Then talking about handing out relief to hurricane victims in Haiti. I think it's all about still trying to live down that somewhat unflattering portrayal in Team America.
Matt Damon. Matt Damon. Matt Damon. Matt Damon.
Thank you to whoever had the free time to put all those together on YouTube. And on Tuesday, while the markets were tanking, you might have missed this, General Motors officially unveiled its upcoming electric vehicle, the Chevy Volt. I say unveiled with air quotes because the earliest one might be able to get this very expensive car will be with the 2011 model year. And this is also like the fifth time GM has unveiled the Volt. Presumably they'll do it again when and if you can actually buy the thing. The Volt was on the front page of the GM website this week with the phrase, "The future is here." No, it's not, really. The future is actually right where you'd expect it to be, about 2 years from now, when you can actually buy a Chevy Volt. The Volt is even showing up in GM advertising, an interesting case of a company advertising a product it doesn't actually make. It's like Apple saying, "Hey, look, a computer that fits inside your eyeball. Won't that be cool when we can make that? Now buy a Mac." But you know, GM, while you're at it, why stop there? Coming in 2015, the Pontiac Mulch. The world's first SUV to run on switchgrass and bacon grease. In 2021, get your hands on a Buick Sentient, the sedan that drives itself. Just kick back, read the paper, and listen to Howard Stern live from the old folks' home. Then in 2035, GM brings you the Saturn Nimbus, a flying car, finally, just like the Jetsons. And in 2052, prepare yourself for the Cadillac Clipper, a car that runs on nothing but toenails and wishes. General Motors. Tomorrow's technology, advertised today. And this is The Week from In the Loop. I am Jeff Horwich. Hurricane Ike, of course, the week's other major news story before the collapsing U.S. financial markets drew our attention away, taking out the town of Galveston, Texas, and doing severe damage to a number of other places around the Gulf Coast. Of course, in the midst of a hurricane evacuation, it's difficult to find people where you might expect them otherwise, but we did manage to track down Angelina Harrison, who is usually from Galveston. Angelina, thanks very much. I know it's been a strange week, but we're glad to have a few minutes with you.
Thank you. Yes, it's been a very strange and hectic week for myself.
And of course, you're not in Galveston right now. Where are you exactly?
I'm actually in Lamarck, staying with friends, which is about 15 miles away from Galveston.
Nobody's getting into Galveston at this point, so you haven't seen it. What have you heard about conditions on the island?
I've been told that thousands of homes have been washed away. You know, looting is a concern. There's no power there. There's no gas. There's no water.
Is there any way for you to learn specifically about your house?
Well, I've heard from some city workers that I do know that are neighbors that are there working, that the house is intact, but every single home that's still standing did have flood waters to come into the first level. So there's going to be water damage.
What are they telling you about when you will be able to go back?
Right now, they're telling us that the city of Galveston or Galveston Island is not livable. The sewer has backed up. Debris has come into the neighborhoods, has come into the streets, have gone into the sewer. I don't think the city is trying to put a time frame on it. Now they're using the word Galveston is off limits or closed until further notice.
Well, that's not very comforting, I suppose.
Not at all.
So you're staying with friends in Lamarck?
Yes. And I applied online with FEMA for housing. Since there's no power where I am, I have to be dependent upon other friends and call them and say, "Hey, can you go online and apply for me?" And so I'm actually on the phone with them while they're on the other end applying for FEMA for me, you know, asking me the questions, telling me what the answers are. And
friends in other parts of the country.
Yes, exactly.
Because, of course, they have power and no one there does.
Correct.
So one thing that it sounds like you're discovering, and the rest of us are discovering through you, is that when there's no power, there can be a lot of plans in place, but a whole heck of a lot of things that we would plan to do for people like you don't work very well.
Correct, correct. I mean, my day consists of finding who's giving out ice, who's giving out water, and who's giving out food. I'm literally in my parents' car, and we're riding around, you know, Lamarck and Texas City, to find out where is it that we need to go. You know, I'm totally relying on text messages, so if someone finds where is the FEMA booth or table where I need to go, you know, I have to rely on someone else to either send that information to me or call me on the phone and tell me.
With all the other stuff that's been in the news this week, the big financial collapse, I kind of feel like, you know, the damage from Ike might be slipping from people's attention rather quickly. Is that okay if the rest of us just move on and leave you all down there to pull things back together?
No, I think that everyone in the country should really, really pay attention to what happened here because it's going to affect everyone. We have refineries in the Gulf, Houston area, the Ship Channel, very heavy populated chemical and oil plants, and they had to shut down production. They also had damage on some of their platforms within the Gulf as well. We are already seeing the immediate effects of the gas prices. They're already talking about food prices increasing. So keep your eye on what's going on in this particular area because it's going to definitely trickle down to the rest of the economy and to the entire country.
We make a strong argument. Angelina Harrison, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For another take on Ike, let's switch phone lines here and talk with Ben Smilowitz. He's the founder of the Disaster Accountability Project. It's a nonprofit set up after the rather dismal performance of FEMA and some relief agencies after Katrina. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So if the FEMA response to Hurricane Katrina was like a 1 or a 2, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, where do you put Ike so far?
I'd say it's probably a 5 or a 4.
Where are you seeing FEMA improve this time around?
Generally, FEMA's communication systems are probably much better with other federal agencies. There have been a lot of internal tweaking since Katrina. A lot of recommendations have been implemented, but many have not, and we're seeing a lot of those come to light through a lot of the suffering on the ground.
It sounds like you've got a longer list of negatives then. Where are they falling short?
Lack of information is a huge issue on the ground. A lot of people are listening to the radio, but one thing we've realized is that there are no stations dedicated to only information about long lists, county by county, of open shelters. So we've been getting calls on our hotline from individuals not knowing where to take their family to sleep, or even individuals that have driven to closed hospitals to use a nebulizer for their asthma, and they've got no idea where to go next.
We just talked with someone who's been evacuated from Galveston, and she said that a lot of what she needs to do in terms of finding information and registering for things, she's supposed to do online. That sounds fairly awkward when even in her evacuated location, there's no power.
We got a lot of calls from peeved-off people who have been told to go online, and they call us and like, well, we only can use our phones. We even call the FEMA number if we can get through, if it's not busy. And when people are told to go online, after all they've been through, they get just really frustrated, and they see the system isn't working. After Katrina, we found that everyone was asked to call a number for services at the Red Cross. We found later that there were far fewer lines open than there were supposed to be. So these are all lessons we realize, and then hopefully they're actually learned later.
What's your assessment of how the evacuations worked this time around?
Well, it took days even for the Galveston mayor to order the evacuation, and then 1,000 prisoners were still left on the island in a prison during the storm. It was a pretty scary situation. Galveston did evacuate a lot of people, though we're looking at 20,000 that are still there and that don't want to leave. And for all those people that are staying in Galveston, that means that they have to have many more people there to support them when they start to drop with stomach ailments and dehydration. And if those emergency personnel didn't have to be there for some stubborn people who don't want to evacuate, they would be able to tend to other people in other parts of the state. So far from a success, but I think also it's a large place and they got a lot of people out. So I would give it mixed reviews.
You know, natural disasters are unpredictable. I mean, by definition, they're catastrophic. What can we really expect from FEMA and relief agencies?
That they will be there and tell people what to expect. Also, make changes that have been recommended after Katrina, really. I mean, there are thousands of them that came from the GAO, even the White House. If they just listened to their own people, they would be in a much better position than they are now.
Ben, thank you for keeping an eye on things, and thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
That's Ben Smilowitz, founder of the Disaster Accountability Project. Find more about them at disasteraccountability.org. Now, before we send you off into a wonderful weekend, let's bring things back to our country's precarious financial situation. Sorry. Dan Ninus is a listener of ours here in the Twin Cities who has been worrying about this crisis for much longer than the rest of us. You might say he was there when it all started. The guys behind Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. Dan's one of them. And yet, he is so not one of them.
I'm a financial pessimist. Nothing ever goes right with money. Every paycheck is my last. Well, at least in my head. This is a good thing, though, for a man in my profession. You see, I'm a banker. It's part of my job to look at customers' private financial information and to know what they can and cannot afford. So when my wife and I decided to get our first mortgage, I took it very seriously. I forced us to tally up every expense we could think of. I even debated shaving my head to be able to save money on haircuts. And then we planned for the worst. What if one of us got sick or lost their job? After days of poring over these numbers, we came up with what we could afford. And it was no mansion. No big house with a backyard and a two-stall garage. Instead, a townhouse with a low association fee. Then I went to work. I started looking at the loan applications and scratched my head. People who made the same as my wife and I were trying to buy twice the house that we did. And if my bank turned them down, they'd just walk into the big bank next door and be approved in minutes. Were these people getting over their heads, or had I been too cautious? Then I got jealous. These people had my two-stall garage, and I was parking on the street. I started to rethink our finances. Maybe we could afford more than I thought. Maybe I should live it up and put granite countertops in the kitchen. And just as I was going to Lowe's, the market hit a wall. All those high-risk loans that were given out by mortgage brokers like candy started going bad. And the investment firms who bought up those mortgages, like Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers, are now taking a beating. If the market wasn't bad enough, it seems like everybody is paying more to live. And the people in my dream home, with their huge mortgage, they're struggling to get by. So my pessimism paid off, but I don't feel good about it. It's hard to feel good when others are suffering. All of this reminds me of a story my mom read me when I was a kid. It was about an ant and a grasshopper. The ant worked all summer long, gathering and storing grain in his home, while the grasshopper danced and played. When the winter came, the grasshopper starved. The ant stayed warm and well-fed. Now the ant, being a good soul, invited the grasshopper in to share his food and home. I always respected that ant. He didn't gloat, he didn't brag. Instead, he took care of the grasshopper, even if he had made some foolish mistakes. But as I sit at my banker's desk, it's not so simple. I wish we could help all those in need. Unfortunately, as I look at the state of the economy, I can only come to one conclusion. There's too many grasshoppers and not enough ants.
The thoughts of listener and banker Dan Ninus. The Week is produced by Sandin Totten and me. We are edited by Kate Smith. Special help this week from Anna Wagle and Public Insight Journalism. Our theme and much of our other music is by The Smarts. Thanks to everybody who sent in those Sarah Palin poems we requested. Some of them are, they're really, really angry. And we're going to sort through them and maybe bring you one or two next week. And hey, we're still waiting for that perfect Joe Biden poem. Reach us by email, join our listener network, get the podcast all at minnesotapublicradio.org/in the loop. I'm Jeff Horwich, and I'm going to go check my portfolio.